Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcast on autoimmune conditions and COVID-19. My name is Sam Robinson and I am a GP and an e-learning fellow for the RCGP. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Kevin Barrett. Kevin is a GP partner in Hertfordshire, a primary care commissioner and the chair of the Primary Care Society of Gastroenterology. He was also the RCGP's and Crohn's and Colitis UK clinical champion the 2017 to 2020 Inflammatory Bowel Disease Spotlight Project. Hi, Kevin, and thank you for your time today.
Hi, Sam. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. We're going to do some talking about autoimmune conditions and COVID-19. So just to start us off, could you tell us a little bit more about the interaction between these two illnesses and whether there are any specific autoimmune conditions which may make you more susceptible to COVID?
Oh gosh, absolutely. This is one of those areas that is incredibly fascinating. I think COVID has really made everyone much more aware of what happens with autoimmune conditions and the process that go on as well. It's created a huge amount of debate at the moment and research is still ongoing. I know when we had a discussion before we recorded this podcast about some of the things, and even in that intervening time, in those few weeks, there's been so much stuff that's been published and released about it. Things are changing all the time. So it's going to be hard to kind of give an exact up-to-date things. I'm sure in a week or two time, things will be different. But I think that the thing about autoimmune conditions and COVID is that we know that now that COVID-19, one of the things that's really not unique, but one of the things that actually makes COVID such an illness that's different to lots of other viral illnesses, it triggers similar processes in the body to those that occur with autoimmune conditions. So some of the manifestations we're seeing with COVID actually do mirror what happens with autoimmune diseases. And I think a lot of that is to do with what happens with those glycoproteins on the surface of the COVID virus, the spike glycoproteins or spike proteins, they're called different things with that too. They're the ones that seems to cause the biggest issue. And we know that they're the ones that kind of get into the cells, they get in through ACE2 receptors on the surface of cells, and they're the ones that trigger off things. Originally, we thought that COVID-19 was purely a respiratory type illness, but actually we know now it's a complete multi-system disease, so it can affect almost any part of the body. So lungs, absolutely, skin. So we've seen rashes as part of that manifestation, kidneys, heart, blood vessels with all the clotting, coagulation, leaky vessels that occur with it as well. Digestive tract, so it can cause inflammation of the digestive tract as well, and the nervous system, so central nervous system and peripheral system. So all the parts of the body can be affected by it as well. The data we looked at beforehand as well looks at autoimmune conditions. There's a wide variety of those. And as far as I can tell, there's no clear evidence that any one autoimmune condition is particularly worse to have if one's infected with COVID than any others. I think there is one of those multi-system things where we know that certainly, you know, overweight and obesity is one of those conditions that actually does make one more likely to be worse off if one's affected by COVID. And lots of the treatments and autoimmune conditions themselves that lead to obesity can actually therefore indirectly make you more likely to become worse off as well. And those autoimmune conditions where one takes multiple immunosuppressive treatments, again, indirectly increase that risk. But there's not a direct link between an autoimmune condition and becoming more unwell with COVID. I think the biggest risk actually is having an undertreated or a poorly controlled autoimmune condition. That is the biggest issue rather than the actual autoimmune condition itself. Also thinking about some of the treatments that we use for COVID-19 and autoimmune conditions. So there's been lots of things written about using autoimmune suppressive treatments to treat COVID. And the latest update for NICE guidance was published over the summer. You know, and some of the treatments that we've used to treat COVID are actually the same ones that we use to treat autoimmune conditions. So you've got your straightforward immunosuppressive treatments, steroids, dexamethasone, prednisolone, hydrocortisone, those sorts of ones that we use particularly in hospital-based settings, not necessarily out in the community and in primary care. There's also using some of the interleukin-6 receptor antibodies. So tocilizumab is one, if I've pronounced that correctly. It's not one we particularly use out in primary care as well. So that's one thing that's used to treat inflammatory arthritis conditions in adults and children. And again, that's something that's being looked at to treat COVID in hospital-based settings as well. So there's a big overlap between the treatments we use for that as well. I'm not really going to talk about hydroxychloroquine and those sorts of treatments as well, because they're definitely not recommended. And the NICE is very clear that those ones are not recommended for treatments of COVID, even though there was interest in that back in the early days, you know, 18 months or so ago with that too.
That's really interesting. And I think you're right. There is a huge overlap between a lot of the symptoms from autoimmune disease and the COVID-19, a lot of the inflammatory processes. So it's really interesting. When you mentioned the fact that no specific autoimmune disease seems to be worse off in relation to COVID, what I have been reading recently is that there's some vaccine hesitancy in the autoimmune community. I just wondered what you thought could be behind this.
Absolutely. As we know with the general population, and certainly as time goes on, that there's people either feel very strongly one way or the other about this, and there's a big group in the middle who may be unsure about things too. And people do change their mind. You know, people that were hesitant about having vaccinations actually then, you know, realise that actually it is the right thing to do, that they should be vaccinated. There's still one of those things about the COVID vaccinations being a relatively untried treatment, but we know that the vaccines themselves for it, that they've been in development and were used for treating a whole range of other conditions before that technology was used to convert them to produce the spike protein for COVID. So they're not brand new technology. I think, as we said before, it's that spike protein that seems to be the issue that we need to inject in people to actually make sure that they do produce that immunity. But it's that protein itself that can trigger off some of the reactions that people are getting with the vaccinations as well. If we look at what the Joint Committee for Vaccination and Immunisation, so JCVI, that we hear about on the news all the time, and their main publication, which healthcare professionals always call the Green Book, because historically it used to be published in a paper format that had a green cover. So over the last 9 to 10 months, all the times, every time they've updated that, they've continued to say that patients who are immunosuppressed either by disease or indirectly through treatment, or and they specifically mention a lot of autoimmune conditions in there. So multiple sclerosis, diabetes in there, autoimmune hepatitis, SLE, all those sorts of conditions as well are actually mentioned in there as well. And they very clearly state that all of those groups should be vaccinated against COVID-19 because the risk of becoming ill, becoming hospitalised, becoming of death from it, of having post-COVID syndrome, are actually much, much greater than any potential risk from the vaccines themselves. And they're also very clear to state that that all of the COVID vaccines currently available are safe for all patients with autoimmune diseases. So absolutely, and that's been consistent throughout all of this. And there's no evidence that's emerged to say the opposite too. There has been some issue because when clinical trials are done, they tend to recruit healthy volunteers, and they exclude a lot of people that have long-term health conditions for a whole variety of reasons. So some of the vaccine hesitant groups are saying, well, actually, they've not tested these vaccines in these groups. And that's true. Those initial trials did take place in healthy individuals without pre-existing conditions. But they have actually looked at now short-term studies. And I think the latest data sort of looked at around about 6 weeks after vaccination, because it takes a while for the data to be gathered and things to be published, even though the vaccines have been done since December, given to the population since December 2020, that actually, again, there's no evidence to say there's any particular issues for people with autoimmune conditions when they're given the vaccines too. The other issue actually that's come up is about, is it worth being vaccinated if I have a long-term condition because my immune system is suppressed? So, you know, why should I bother if I'm not actually going to get a good immune response? And again, there is a degree of truth in that. However, some response is better than no response. And there are definitely studies out there that show that people who are immunosuppressed, you know, you're still fairly likely to actually get a good, strong immune response. It might not last quite as long, and it might not be quite as strong. So the latest guidance about people having their third vaccination rather than the booster, so that their primary course will now consist of three vaccines rather than the two that the general population gets. The reason for that is because about 40% of patients actually have, you know, don't have a detectable immune response afterwards. So There are a number of studies out there being published all the time. I won't name any particular ones because I'm sure there'll be more published on a weekly or monthly basis over this time as well. But if you look at patients, one group I'm particularly interested in are patients with inflammatory bowel disease, and those patients treated with infliximab. When they're infected with COVID, only about half of them actually get detectable antibodies in their system after being infected. So that those are antibodies typically to the nucleotide antibodies rather than the spike antibodies on that as well. But we know that the antibody response, it's a good surrogate marker of immunity, but it doesn't look at the whole immune system response to it as well. But actually that group, if you give the same group of patients who have inflammatory bowel disease who are on anti-TNF drugs, so infliximab, after vaccination, they did have that rise in their antibody levels. So even though you might not get an immune response to being ill with COVID, you certainly should get, in the majority of cases, a response to being vaccinated. So yeah, there's still lots of research going on there. And I think there's still the general consensus actually is that people should definitely be vaccinated if they have an autoimmune condition, because it is definitely worth doing. And the evidence is there to support that.
That's really helpful. I think I had heard about the vaccine trials and that people were concerned that actually the vaccine hadn't been trialed on those with autoimmune disease, but it certainly sounds like now they've done research into it and they should be having their vaccination. So that's really helpful to go over that. Are they more likely to get side effects from the vaccines?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think like lots of things, it does depend upon the individual. Again, it's that particular spike protein itself that tends to trigger off the reactions in lots of people. So we used to say when people had their flu jabs, their seasonal flu vaccine, for example, that actually the worse they felt, the better it was, because they're more likely to have a good immune response. And I don't know how much actual truth in that there is, but it just, it helps people feel a bit better if they feel miserable afterwards, because it kind of, makes you feel that your immune system's responding. But I don't actually know how much truth's in that as well. So we know that the response to COVID vaccination varies widely from person to person. And again, huge range of factors in that. So, where the needle goes in, how, the time of day even can make a difference on it. So all these different factors do make a difference with it as well. Some people might feel worse on average afterwards, and some people might not even be aware they've been vaccinated at all, but that doesn't necessarily mean the vaccine hasn't been affected. It's variable with that too. So I don't think we should tell people, they should feel better or worse than other people with it as well. In terms of allergic reactions and blood clots, for example, those are two things patients often ask us about as well. There's no evidence at all that patients with autoimmune conditions are more likely to suffer allergic reactions or get blood clots afterwards. So they're actually as safe to be given for patients with autoimmune conditions as for the general population as well. So again, it just comes down to the that slight autoimmune response. Again, there's lots written about that. I think since we last spoke, Sam, that there's been some discussion about changes in periods because of slightly sort of leaky capillaries, and does that have an impact on it as well? And again, I suspect if your immune system is, if you're in the middle of a flare or you've got uncontrolled disease, your immune system is going to be slightly more active than perhaps the general population might be. But again, so those individuals may suffer slightly different reactions and a slightly more severe reaction. But again, it's short term, it's short lived. There's no evidence that actually a blip in arthritis or a transient change in the bowel symptoms actually translates into any long term problems and anything requiring treatment. So the evidence is very, very, it is not there for that to happen. So that's not a reason for people not to be vaccinated. So they definitely should be vaccinated as well. And I guess the other thing that to think about as well is about Guillain-Barré syndrome as well. So again, if you read what the Green Book says, the JCVI guidance about COVID vaccinations, there were some concerns that people that had Guillain-Barré syndrome in the past, that it may actually happen again if they're given a vaccination, because again, the effect on the immune system. But again, the current evidence is there's no likelihood that may happen, and that having a previous history of Guillain-Barré syndrome is not a contraindication of being vaccinated against COVID. So in summary, I think yes, go ahead and they absolutely should get vaccinated.
That's great. That's really good to know. And I think will definitely make me feel more confident when I'm having this discussion with my patients who are a bit more hesitant to have the vaccine. For those who maybe don't have the vaccine or who are just unlucky enough to pick up COVID and then they have an autoimmune condition as well, do they have a worse outcome than those who don't have an autoimmune illness?
I think when COVID first hit the UK back in February, March, April 2020, there was the fear that that might happen. And organisations that included the British Society of Gastroenterology, the British Society of Rheumatology, British Association of Dermatologists, all those ones involved with treating autoimmune conditions, they produced risk stratification tools for patients with autoimmune diseases. The original ones they produced were actually fairly blanket policies, and they actually said that almost every patient on any disease-modifying treatment whatsoever was considered to be clinically extremely vulnerable. And you know, almost any treatment, any patient on any of those treatments was sent a shielding letter, considered clinically extremely vulnerable, to use the latest terminology for that. However, as studies and evidence came out of actually looking at people who've been admitted to hospital, who've been infected with COVID, came out, actually that there was a lot of evidence to say that the vast majority of those patients actually weren't at significantly increased risk. Some were at increased risk, but not all. So they could actually tweak that and relax some parts and produce more specific guidance on it as well. And those organisations then updated that guidance around about Easter time. So it didn't take long for them to update that guidance. And when I last looked recently, that guidance hadn't really changed much since Easter. So those risk stratification tools and grids that the various organisations produced have actually been fairly consistent since around about that time. So again, looking at the databases, so lots of organisations, when a patient with COVID is admitted to hospital or has a positive COVID test, they're recruited and their details are entered on a database, obviously with patient consent, etc. So one I'm again with my gastro hat on, I'm particularly interested in is Secure IBD. So that looks at patients across the world who have been diagnosed with COVID. So it's a worldwide collaboration, which I think it just emphasised how much of a worldwide impact this had and the response it's had. So they've had over 6,500 cases reported. So the database includes details of their age, their gender, the disease type, the medication they're on. And it actually shows that the biggest risk for those patients were being on high doses of systemic steroids and having active disease. So again, as we said before, that those very clear things, that those, if your immune system is heavily suppressed or you have disease that's poorly controlled, then absolutely that does put you at a bigger risk as well. And again, the larger the number of disease-modifying treatments that you're on, so if you're on a biologic plus azathioprine plus something else plus steroids, then that dramatically increases your risk than if you're just on one treatment alone. The biologics, which again, a wide range of those drugs that are given by secondary care to our patients, that we used to assume were the ones that actually, you know, suppressed your immune system to the greatest extent. Actually, lots of those turn out not to increase your risk significantly at all, and some of them even actually might even lower the risk of COVID. So the data is not perfect, and there's reporting bias and things like that in it as well. But again, all of those things do go on to support those risk stratification tools and risk grids that are produced in Easter 2020 as well. So they're all publicly available that we can have a look at. For both healthcare professionals and patients, and some of the organisations, so Crohn's and Colitis UK, for example, that they've actually produced a tool that you can use in conjunction with some of those organisations to actually personalise your own risk with that. So there's lots of things out there for people. I know, hopefully, at the moment we're kind of talking about a historic thing as the situation is changing, but who knows what's going to happen in the future? So it's worth still being aware that those things exist as well. The key message from that bit really is to say the important thing for patients is to keep taking the medication that they're on. That's the thing. So don't stop the medication. If you're infected with COVID, if you're about to be vaccinated, unless you're specifically told otherwise by your specialist, don't stop that treatment. Carry on taking it, because the risk of untreated disease actually with COVID far outweighs the risk of being on immunosuppressive treatment for that condition as well. Equally, it still applies to steroids, disease-modifying drugs, biologic medications, applies to children, adults, pregnant women even as well. So the same thing applies to that. Keep taking the medication and don't stop it unless the specialist says otherwise, which in reality occurs quite rarely.
Really interesting and really helpful. Again, I think knowing that we can just reassure our patients to continue taking their medication, like you said, unless they've been told specifically by their specialist not to, is really, really helpful. Do you think COVID will have any long-term effects on the general population in terms of autoimmunity? We've discussed how it's similar to, or has a similar process potentially to autoimmune diseases. Do you think, therefore, it increases the risk of people developing autoimmune diseases later on if they've had COVID? And my second question related is, do you think there might be any positive impacts from COVID-19 at all in the world of autoimmunity?
That latter question is fascinating. I'll save that to the end, I think. In terms of the long-term effects on the general population and the potential for triggering autoimmune disease, particularly new autoimmune disease, we know that certainly you can get a transient increase in the symptoms and people get if they have an autoimmune condition when they have COVID, for example, or even if they're vaccinated, you get a very temporary increase in that sometimes. In terms of it triggering off a new autoimmune disease, again, the data is very limited on this, and I'm not aware of any studies that have looked at the incidence or the rates of autoimmune conditions being diagnosed in people who've had COVID. Theoretically, I guess it's possible that people who are about to develop something may have their immune system kickstarted by COVID, and therefore they go on to develop it as well. But again, we're still waiting to see whether that actually pans out into reality or not. Post-COVID syndrome, or long COVID as it used to be known, there certainly are some elements of that that could be autoimmune mediated. That's a huge area, lots of research, lots of money's been poured into it at the moment because there are lots and lots of people being affected by that. And that it may well be that some elements of that in some people may actually be mediated by the autoimmune system. So, I don't know. Again, people's health-seeking behaviours and diagnostic rates and things, that they've all been markedly affected by COVID. So I think it may be a couple of years yet until we see that clarity emerge. But it's nothing clear about that yet. And in terms of that, the second part of your question about any positives that come out of it as well, I mean, clearly it's enabled people to reevaluate their lives and to think about what's important to them as well. And that applies equally to patients with autoimmune conditions as it does to the general population. In terms of treating things, often these worldwide crises do trigger new technologies and new innovations coming out as well. There are some new therapies that are being explored. So the NMAbs, which are neutralizing monoclonal antibodies, a couple of those have been licensed at the moment and some more are due online at the moment. And these actually target either the spike protein directly that sits on the surface of the COVID virus, or some of them actually look at the receptor, the ACE2 receptor that sits on the cells, and actually block COVID from entering the cells because it therefore can't get in because that protein's been affected, or the binding site's been affected as well. So these are like a passive immunity version. In the same way that we give varicella chickenpox immunoglobulin to people who aren't immune, so women who are pregnant who are exposed to chickenpox, we don't want them catching it if they're not already immune. So we give them a passive immune a boost of immunoglobulins. So the principles have been there for a long time. And some of these treatments have been trialed beforehand. So there's some famous people who were given some of these experimental treatments very early on as well, but they're becoming more mainstream and actually becoming licensed with trials as well. So there are trials that started in September 2021. They're ongoing until November 2021 as well. Whether or not they will be useful for the wider population is unknown at the moment, because the production of the NMAbs is quite limited. They're very expensive to do, so they are being kept for patients who are either immunocompromised themselves, so we'll see what happens with those, and it'll be fascinating to see what happens with those trials that come out as well. It's technically not directly related to autoimmune diseases and patients with autoimmune conditions, but certainly for some patients who actually can't mount an effective autoimmune response themselves, you know, that I think that group certainly may benefit from those as well. I think COVID definitely has changed people's society, or changed society's perception of vulnerability and who's vulnerable or not. And certainly we did see a lot more kindness and awareness of invisible illnesses during COVID. That might be waning slightly at the moment as well. But, you know, we know that although many people actually look well on the outside, they can be vulnerable and they have health conditions that put them at risk. And I think, I really hope that tolerance does continue in the post-COVID era that we're hopefully entering at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely noticed that increase in kindness and willingness to accept and understand other people's illnesses that maybe wasn't there prior to COVID. So hopefully there will be some positives that have come out of it. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for your insight, Kevin. It's been really, really thought-provoking. And thank you for listening to the RCGP podcast on autoimmune conditions and COVID-19.